Welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. This is your host, Ishai Breslauer. Here we meet every Monday to talk commercial real estate and prop tech. We will dive deep into the different asset classes, discuss the market, talk about the new and exciting technologies, meet key people in the industry, and get some inspiration. Let's begin. Hey guys, before we start, I just want to point out the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. It's a free download. Go to the text side and you will find it. It has absolutely great information, completely free, how to become a landlord, how to determine the value of a property, or creative financing for commercial real estate. All of it is completely free. Go download it. Also, I want to point out my CRE crash course. It's a 2-week must-have program with a must-have skills for commercial real estate, like investment strategies, the must-have financial terms, how a deal is done. Go take a look at it, go to the text side and click on the link. And now let's continue with our program. Hey guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, your host of the CRE Shark Eye Show. Today with us is Logan Freeman. And you can already, if you are on the visual format, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see the background, and you guys are listening to the podcast medium. I'm just going to read it to you. On the back of him, it says invest for the win. And that is his podcast and his movement. And we're going to hear all about it. Logan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm excited for our conversation.
Unbelievable. You know, before we even start, if you could give us like a 2-minute elevator pitch about what is Logan about, who are you, what do you guys do? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, really focused on commercial real estate investing, right? So owner operators of commercial real estate. And I say that because I think most people in this space and a lot of the space are focused on multifamily, and that's not exactly all we focus on, right? And so we're Midwest based. I would say that, you know, we're Midwest investors. So you think about Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Oklahoma, Arkansas. That's where we're at, right? The flyover states. You know, that's where we focus at. We're based out of Kansas City, Missouri. We focus on commercial real estate, primarily multifamily, neighborhood retail, shopping centers, mobile home communities and office buildings when it makes sense. And so owner operators means, you know, we are vertically integrated. We are managing our properties. We are brokers. We are developers. We're sponsors. We have a team of 22 people and really trying to focus on making sure that we bring risk-adjusted returns to investors. So understanding where the opportunities are. And you can only do that, in my opinion, by understanding your marketplace that you're investing in and having the best in class relationships. And so when we break down kind of our intellectual capital model, it's broken down into 3 buckets. It's human. So who's on the team, right? We got to have A-class players. It's relational. Who do you know? How can you leverage those relationships? And then it's structural. How is the business running when you're not there, right? Systems, processes, KPIs. And that's really what we focus on, those 3 things, and try to sharpen the saw on those every single day.
You know what? You just threw like, I would say 2,000, so many important items that are out there, and I love it. And it gives us so much material to talk about. But before we go into it, give us a little bit about you, Logan. How did you get into real estate in the first place? Yeah. How old are you, by the way?
Yeah, I'm 32 years old. And
years young. Amazing.
Yeah, there you go. Years
young. So tell us how you guys got into it. How did you start? Go ahead.
Yeah, so I grew up in Jefferson City, Missouri, and that's the capital of Missouri for folks that don't know. I was an athlete my whole life, so I played collegiate football and briefly in the NFL. And when I was cut from the NFL, I knew that I needed to go through some sort of identity change. And so I really started to try to understand how wealth was created. And I wanted to learn. You've got a lot of books there. I've got a lot of books here. And I wanted to learn. So I started reading the books and understood that assets are what create wealth long-term, and specifically cash flowing assets. Well, how do you get into that? Well, you know, bricks and mortar, real estate. And so I have a master's in business, But all we talked about was theoretical ideas the whole time. I wanted to know what business was about. And I found an industry in the real estate world about 5 years ago when I was fired from my last W-2 sales job. And I have a very supportive wife. And she said, Logan, I am going to support you with whatever direction you want to go. And so at that time, I jumped into real estate as the head of acquisitions for a $50 million fund here in Kansas City. Purchasing single family homes at scale. We were the sixth group in the country to go through a CoreVest portfolio refinance on 265 single family homes. And what that means is, you know, we recapitalized that whole portfolio with a non-recourse debt option. And it was a very enlightening process. And so I sat down with the sponsors of that fund afterwards, and they told me what the structure was. And they said, Logan, we syndicated this equity. And I got the bug. And so I went back to the educational circuits. I moved my license to a commercial multifamily brokerage. I started to work with 1031 exchange buyers. And then I started to buy some property myself, quickly ran out of money and said, you know what? I think this is the right time for me to transition into a business ownership standpoint. Found some business partners. That took me 15 months to find them, vetted them. We started to do deals back in 2019, and we're sitting here in 2022 with 1,300 units across four states and refocusing into different asset classes. So that was my trajectory.
You know what? Amazing. And you gave us like in a brief, but I want to go back a little bit to get the juice out of it because it's sure. such an amazing story. I want to go back for a second to the point where you know, after you read all the books and after you got self-education, you got this whole idea, you went and you worked for a fund, a $50 million fund, private equity fund, obviously, that went and invested in real estate. How did you get in there, first of all? Meaning you came in as a guy who is not so much in real estate and you said, I want to be in acquisitions here. It doesn't come just like that. How did you get in? Meaning
relationships. So I had bought my first single family home here in Kansas City. I did a live-in flip, and the gentleman who I bought it from had a commercial or he had a real estate company, property management, construction, and brokerage. And so when I was fired, I called him. I said, "Hey, I'm really interested in real estate. We've been talking for 3 or 4 years now. Let's figure out if there's an opportunity." And it just so happened that his acquisitions guy was leaving at that time. So a little bit of luck, a little bit of opportunity meets preparation. And that's how I got started. So being able to leverage that relationship and learning from the ground up.
That's amazing. And that's the best way to do it. I always tell people, especially beginners, that if you want to start, you go in as like, you know, management, acquisitions, whatever you can do to come in and get your feet wet and get some experience, you know, on your hands. The one thing I want to ask you is once you got out, you started to go on your own. Tell us about your very first deal.
Yeah.
You told us about that house, but after that, you obviously, as a company, you went for that first deal as a commercial real estate guy. Tell us about that first experience.
Yeah, it was an interesting one, I will tell you. So pretty fun story. So like I mentioned, I represented a lot of, and still do, 1031 exchange buyers. Well, I had been meeting with Parker and Corey, who are my business partners, for about 5 or 6 months. They've been putting offers out on deals, and they called me on a Sunday, and they know Sunday is my Sabbath. And so I said, look, guys, I don't really take business calls on Sunday, but what's up? You know, and they knew that. So I answered. They said, well, we got our first deal. I said, fantastic. What's the address? They told me the address, 1310 Admiral Boulevard. I said, guess what? My client on the 1031 exchange side was the other bidder on that deal. And they paid less, but were able to convince the sellers that they were the right buyers for that property. So I said, if you can't beat them, join them. And so we bought our first 37-unit apartment complex here in Kansas City. And, you know, we had no prior experience raising capital, really. And so I had to make, I think, about 2,500 cold calls and meetings to raise only, you know, $700,000 for that first project. So it was quite the enlightening process. Now we have systems and processes in place to do capital raising at a much higher level now. But at that time, we did not. And so it was a lot of cold calls. It was a lot of time with me spending with individuals and getting them to invest in us as principals, not necessarily the real estate experience that we had. So that was the first project, man. And then we, you know, started to put out offers on other deals. And
how much?
You
know, I'm sorry, I'm stopping you, but how much that the total deal, total capitalization, the whole deal, How much
was it? I believe it was about 2.5 million.
And how do you, and there, and the equity raise was
right around 700,000.
700,000, okay. And you had to make all these calls for it. And then you had the debt. How did you guys get a loan as beginners?
Yeah. So, I mean, we had to sign on a personal guarantee, a recourse loan with a local bank. And through my banking relationships and through Parker and Corey's relationships, we were able to get them to kind of take a bet on us and, you know, fully guaranteeing the loan. You know, so we had the assets to obviously get the loan. But at the end of the day, it was really a relationship to say, hey, we are new buyers in the space. We have a lot of real estate experience, but not a ton on the principal side together. And so we had to, you know, just leverage another relationship to be able to get that deal over the finish line.
And you guys managed it yourself?
We did. Yeah, absolutely. So we managed it ourselves. We managed all of our units up to about 250 units and then started to work with third-party property management, have since brought in back in-house about 600 units, and it'll be close to about 1,000 units here pretty soon that we're managing ourselves. But first year, absolutely, we were managing that. And so, you know, when our property manager was not there or they were out on the weekend and somebody said, hey, my refrigerator went out, guess what? It was Parker, Corey, and myself walking up three flights of stairs carrying a refrigerator to those units.
That's incredible. Tell me something. Okay, so from that point, you're already growing.
Yeah.
You're growing from that point and you're starting getting more and more and more. But it, you know, at a certain point, you start finding out, just like every private equity firm or an investment firm or a principal, a sponsor, you were trying to see, I need more equity. I need, obviously, I need more, you know, moving parts in this whole equation, right? And you are, did you, by the way, still do the brokerage at the same time?
I was still doing brokerage. Yeah, we're still doing, you know, 1031 exchange buyer representation, and turned out to be a great opportunity because we found a lot of passive investors through that realm, but also we're able to build up the broker relationships and owner relationships to find deals that made sense for our clientele, who typically have a lower cost of capital with a 1031 exchange and want stabilized. And we were willing to do more value add and do on, you know, a little bit larger transactions. So the brokerage definitely still helped supplement some of the revenues at that time.
Right. That's amazing. So growing up, meaning you're obviously your database with more investors. How did you guys do that? Where'd you go? Where elsewhere did you go? And what are the functions that you guys went for? You know,
it's a multi-pronged approach. You know, I think that you know, we have to look at it from a lot of different standpoints. It's at the early days, it was me, you know, meeting a lot of people, telling people what we were doing, asking if they would be interested in investing in real estate. And then I found kind of a better way, right? So this is the online way of attracting passive investors through different podcasts and LinkedIn and different marketing channels using PPC, pay-per-click advertising, and different ways to bring in passive investors. But you know, when we first started, it was really, you know, friends, family, not a lot of family, a lot of friends that we ended up raising capital from. And then just, you know, them taking a leap of faith with us at that time. And I'll tell you this, when we started raising most of our capital was after March of 2020. So get this, you know, first deals done in 19 and then COVID hits. And there was a time period, if you look at Green Street's property price index, from April of 2020 to about October, where prices were actually, you know, lower than they were previously. And then they skyrocketed. But that's when we went out and bought 1,000 units. So not only did we have to raise capital during a very tumultuous time, we had to find contrarian investors. We had to find people who were willing to take a bet on us as principals. And we had to find it during a period of time where we had, you know, global lockdowns. And so it was a difficult time to raise equity. And we did a lot of different ideas to get that those deals over the finish line. Very thankful that we were able to do that. But previous to 19 and when we first did our first projects, we spent some time out in Silicon Valley talking to Apple and Google and Amazon and eBay at their internal interest groups on how to invest out of state. And so we had a pretty steady pipeline of passive investors that were reaching out to us, wanting to learn more about that. And then when the pandemic hit, some of those investors, you know, started to talk about real estate, thinking about that was the right time to get in. And they just jumped on board with us and have ridden that ship with us ever since.
That's amazing. You guys didn't sleep. That's for sure. It's an incredible thing. Tell me something. You guys, obviously COVID hit and everything started to change. And, you know, we all felt it in different ways. What I want to know is you had already assets. You already had multifamily assets. How did they perform and how did you guys handle, you know, the tenants, the difficulties, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, we tried to do it as best as we could, as everybody else was in a very changing, rapidly changing environment. But I would say that trying to get ahead of the communication with our residents was really important. So, you know, had to figure out, okay, what resources are available to the residents? Let's make those easily available. So all of our property managers really needed to know the process. They needed to know what options were available. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're here in Missouri and Kansas, Nebraska and Iowa. And, you know, a lot of the businesses that people work at that live in our properties were essential businesses. And so I think the Midwest was somewhat insulated in regards to, you know, not being able to work or things like that. And we primarily focus on Class B and C multifamily assets. And so a lot of those folks still had jobs. And if they didn't, then we just got proactive with those folks and tried to help them. And it took a lot of time with our property managers and with our team to be able to provide those resources, understand the landscape, and then all of the communication that we had to go through that. So we didn't see a very big drop in collections or anything in regards to that. I mean, I think some of that was, you know, federal government pumping in stimulus money to people. So they had more money maybe than they did previously. But also just getting proactive and being communicative with the residents was really important. And then telling our property managers, hey, this is going to be a tough time. You know, this is going to be different. It's going to take more time. We need you on board. And here's the plan. So laid out the plan from an executive level and then communicated that to our property managers and then try to work with our residents on a regular basis. But, you know, Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas really didn't shut down as bad, I think, as maybe some of the, you know, the gateway markets. And so we didn't see a big drop in collections. So properties did pretty well during that period of time. And, you know, what I'll say too is people didn't want to move during that period of time. You know, maybe they couldn't move. And so, you know, finding a new property was tough or a new unit was tough. So we saw a lot of renewals at that point too.
What a great story. And you know what? Thank God you survived it and you actually probably learned so much from it. But what I want to go for, and you started saying B class, C class, tell us a little bit about your strategies and why did you decide to go for those type of assets?
Yeah. Well, I think that when you're getting started in the commercial real estate space, you know, it's pretty difficult to go compete at the Class A level. One, they're bigger deals. They take a lot more assets to be able to sign on those loans. And your cost of capital typically wants to see some sort of value add opportunity. So we got started with the Class C and B because that was where we thought, you know, we could push the most, you know, appreciation. So we wanted to force appreciation. You know, we tried to buy assets at, you know, what I'll say, a margin of safety that still had the opportunity to either add a cosmetic upgrade or, you know, put in operational
value
efficiency.
Add.
Value add. And so, you know, that was good during that period of time, you know, during 2020 and early 2021, you could find those value add deals that were priced that you didn't have to pay for the value add at the front end. Now everybody is looking for value add deals, and I see brokers sending me deals that say, hey, it's a value add deal because it's below replacement cost. That's not a value add deal. You know, you have to be able to understand what are the rents in the marketplace. What is it going to take for you to get those rents? What do you need to do to the property to do that? And then you can bake in your replacement costs as well. What I'm seeing now is in regards to Class B and C. So when I say Class B, I mean, you know, 2015 to 2000s. Okay. So probably that area, maybe even 1995 to 2015, depending on the property and the location. You know, the construction is newer. It's nicer. You're not going to have as big CapEx issues. But the cap rates compressed between those because there was less value add on Class B and more on Class C. And people were trying to pay for that class or that Class C value add deal. And so those compressed together. So we shifted our focus to buying, you know, some newer properties at that time too, and even started to look at development opportunities because the stabilized yield on costs, you know, started to be the same for a 1970s product versus a 2023 product. And so made a lot of sense for us to start looking at some newer stuff and wait and, you know, until the prices maybe come down on the Class C stuff again. And so I think that for us, the thesis is margin of safety, going in price per door. Love it to be, you know, if it's $50,000 a door, you know, rents need to be $500. You know, it's the old 1% price to rent ratio. It's really simple. You know, what's happened is you'll see a unit for $100,000 and the rents are $600. And that's not, you know, what I'm willing to do. So when things go bad or when there's a hard time, which I think that, you know, we will probably see in our near future, it's good to have a good basis in these properties because you can withstand hard times and challenges.
You need that margin.
You need that margin. And so that's what we are. We're margin, you know, we're margin of safety investors. We're value investors. That has now shifted from multifamily into some shopping centers, into the mobile home space, and into development because that's where we see it. But for us, I'm still very bullish on multifamily. I love multifamily. I just think that the prices that we're seeing out there in the marketplace are hard to warrant any margin of safety. So we just have to be cautious.
So hear me out. So basically, obviously, multifamily is the most desirable asset class because everybody needs a roof over the head. It's something that everybody said, you know, it's most funds are going after it. We all know that, okay? Most investors are bullish on that. It's the safest, especially when it's income producing with a small, what we call a core plus type of a deal, when it's safer and we want to go for it. Now, you've mentioned, obviously, the low caps that we have today, and we all know it. We see it. It's something that everybody is paying attention, and it's harder to get deals. Some of the people are hiring more analysts in order to find more deals. It's getting harder and harder. We know that. We don't know where the market is going. I'd love to hear your opinion about that. But beforehand, you just said you're going for different asset classes because of that. And that means you're going for development. You're going for mobile homes. You're going for shopping centers. Each and every one is a different topic, and I would like to approach it and talk to you about it. But before we go there, let's talk development, because development is something that requires certain expertise, which is by far different, and I want to hear your take on it. And also, the one thing that John Gray from Blackstone, I heard him in an interview talk about it, and he said, and something obviously it's known to everyone, that the one thing about development, and they do go for development as well, but he said that the one thing that they go, that they, you know, when you talk about development, you have to take into consideration the following. Development is something that will be ready within 2 years, sometimes three, and you will be in a different market. Meaning everything that you just said about, I'm buying at 500, whatever, X amount of dollars per door. It doesn't matter what the location is, with wherever you are. And I want to buy it the X amount minus something in order to be able, right, to get to the market. In development, it's obviously a lot harder because you don't know what will be in 3 years or 2 years. And the market is going to be different. Tell us a little bit about that approach and why are you willing to take that risk with development and where's the profit over there? Tell us a little bit about your experience.
Absolutely. Well, so a couple of things. I think that first and foremost, you know, you have to go back to Sam Zell's investment thesis, which is supply and demand. And you need to understand where that is. And it's different for every real estate market. Real estate is not an asset class by itself. It's hyper-local. And so the real estate here is a lot different than the real estate in Dallas-Fort Worth, right? So I have to understand where development trends are going. And that's important because you don't want to go build a 190-unit apartment complex in an area that might be, you know, not the best area in the city, and people don't want to live there. And so we're really bullish on development in areas that we're very familiar with, areas that we've lived in for 8, 10, 12 years. We see other opportunities being developed there as well. And so I think that when I think about development, I look at the supply and demand of where multifamily is, where senior housing is. Our development is actually in senior housing. And, you know, there's 77 million baby boomers out there in the United States now. That means 10,000 people are turning 65 per day. and 4,000 people are turning 85 per day. And there's a deinstitutionalization of senior living. And so you're seeing those folks move into continuum care facilities and independent living facilities and age-restricted multifamily properties because they still want to be in areas around their children, but they also don't want to live in a house or have to take care of a house, or maybe they need some support in regards to, you know, some home health care situation that they want to provide or they need provided, but they don't want to go live at the John Knox villages or the hospitals that look like hospitals, but they're senior living facilities. So that's one big thesis of ours, is understanding that people are getting older, they're going to need a place to live, and I don't think that there is enough of that type of product out there. So that's one thing, is understanding supply and demand, obviously understanding multifamily, where is the demand actually going to be? I think that it's hard to build anything that's not Class A right now, just where construction and labor costs are. And so to be able to warrant the rents that you need, it's much easier to develop in the senior living space because those folks have higher net worth, they have the ability to pay more, and they have the ability and they have the need to actually have more services like home health that they could have in those facilities. So that's the first part. I think the second part here is understanding your market and knowing that, you know, South Kansas City is, you know, I think we have 394 square miles here in Kansas City. It's bigger than New York City from a square mileage standpoint. But we have 2.5 million people in the metro area, and there's a lot of different parts of the city. You know, we're segmented by the Missouri River. So we have North Kansas City, we have South Kansas City, we have Johnson County in Kansas, and all of those have different demand drivers, and you need to understand those. And so I know that right outside this window right here, that the streetcar is going to be stopping right in front of this building. And so I bought a 40,000 square foot office building that I'm sitting in right now, well knowing that I needed to get it leased up, that the streetcar was coming down here, and that there's 8 developments, either multifamily or repurposed historic readaptive use projects along this street that I can look out the window on. And so having that local market knowledge, I think, is extremely important when you're looking to do development. The other piece is for these larger funds, you know, they have billions of dollars that they need to outlay. How can they be experts in every single one of those markets? It's very difficult to do that without local presence. So what you're seeing KKR and Blackstone do is they're buying operating companies that have local market knowledge that also have real estate. So they're buying their talent, they're buying their market knowledge, and that allows them to scale effectively because they can tap into that experience and knowledge and relationship network to actually go do these development deals. And so I think that's the other part too, is just intimately knowing your market, being very comfortable with the supply and demand. That's where I can get comfortable with the development. The last piece for development is you need to have projects that are large enough that you can get a bond. You need an insurance policy on your construction costs. So you need to be able to get a GMAX or a guaranteed max contract with a sizable developer or a construction company. And then you need to get the ability to get a bond on there that basically is an insurance price that says, hey, if lumber goes up 333% again, this insurance policy is going to kick in. And you have to have projects sizable enough to be able to do that so you can keep people busy and you can get those price expectations set. That is the only way that I see development working right now.
Tell me something. When it comes to development again, you guys operate are you operators? Are you the developer or you are the private equity? You are usually an LP or a co-GP. Where is your role in this whole thing?
Yeah, we're development finance guys at this point. So meaning we will go and partner with experienced developers that have already entitled land and they are running point on the projects.
Very, very smart. Very good.
Absolutely.
Excellent answer. I want to shift gears a little bit. We started talking about different asset classes, right? And we have touched shopping centers.
Yeah.
And shopping centers, retail. As a topic, and you obviously know this from the 1031 exchange. Obviously, you dealt with probably the small boxes, the pharmacies, and et cetera, et cetera. So you have the knowledge of retail. And that's a conversation of its own. Let's discuss it a little bit. What Amazon did, or the big, you know, e-commerce revolution did to retail, we all know already. We've discussed it in depth. I had a lot of shows with a lot of retail experts, and we have, you know, went in depth into this topic.
Sure.
But the one thing I want to ask you is, coming from a multifamily environment with investors who are used to multifamily, and I know it because I was wearing that hat. Talking to investors about retail is a lot harder. It's a lot of know-how. It's a lot of understanding of business and understanding what the risks are, which are a lot. It's less tenants. It's the understanding what the e-commerce revolution did. Why not malls? Why yes, shopping centers and all that stuff. Tell us a little bit about your thought process about this whole world of retail, and why are you bullish also about shopping centers?
Yeah, great question. I think that the answer is one of my business partners, Parker Webb, was a retail broker for 8 years previous to FTW, and was also a principal at Midwest Retail Properties, which is the largest Walmart shadow anchored shopping center owner in the country. And so had a ton of experience redeveloping shopping centers, brokering them, and purchasing them for the fund. And so it comes with a lot of experience on the retail side, because like you mentioned, there's different types of retail, and we don't need to talk about that necessarily. But what's important is there's a very small sliver, which is these 25 to 50,000 square foot neighborhood retail shopping centers that have e-commerce resistant service-based tenants in them. So basically the Ace Hardwares or the Dollar Generals, and then you have the potential for a pad site. So you see Arvest now putting in small little banks that you can drive through. You see Scooter's Coffee doing the same thing on these pad sites, which you can re-inject capital. And so the biggest thing for us is understanding that there's a small sliver that we feel very comfortable on that allows for us to feel good about investing in this asset class. It's a contrarian view. And what I mean by that is people think that Amazon is taking over the world, which, you know, on the e-commerce platforms they are. But I just read plenty of articles in regards to e-commerce sites, you know, plummeting on their stock prices. People are wanting to get back out in stores because they believe that they can get a price that is lower in the stores than they can online now. And so I think we're seeing some trends there, but also you can't really buy your tires and get them installed online. I haven't seen that service quite yet.
And yeah, you can't drink your coffee out of your iPhone, and you can't eat, meaning in Arby's. You have to actually go out there. I love your point. It's a great point, meaning the tenant mix is the key here, and the type of tenants that you're going to get in. I love that.
It is right. So important to understand that your traffic counts in Kansas City need to be between 25 and 50,000 cars per day. So people need to be driving by these. They cannot be destination spots for these folks. They need to be accessible. They need to be in the middle of neighborhoods. There needs to be multifamily or single family developments around them. They need to be easy to get to. And then you need to make sure that they feel safe and they feel clean, and they have good tenants in there that are going to attract people in, because that is the most important thing, I think, with these shopping centers is accessibility, location, and then safe and clean. You know, you got the moms that are going with their kids and they want to feel like they're safe at the shopping center, or, you know, they're not going to go, right? They're going to find somewhere else to go, or they're going to buy it online. So there's just some different factors that you have to play into here. And there's not as many of these shopping centers that fit this criterion, which then, you know, carves out exactly what we need to go after to be able to find these. There's two strategies here. There's the stabilized strategy, where you can find a redeveloped shopping center, which might have some vacant spaces in it, or they have some legacy leases, or you go in and you put in new lighting packages. You get the asphalt and the parking lots restriped. You get the lighting for the signage redone. You get the facades redone. You make them feel new, and you got the new wood facades and all of these different things that you can do. There are value add strategies for these shopping centers. A lot of them just feel and look tired. And a lot of it comes down to the signage that are in there, the CapEx that is still sitting there. And when you have a productive and nice looking product, people will come to it because it's going to, you know, make people feel that it's safe and folks are willing to go into these stores. So I think there's some different things, some different strategies that we're implementing. We like both of them. I'm not real big on buying a big vacant, retail shopping center and doing a huge value add play on it. But there are opportunities out there with legacy leases, facade improvements that we can really push these rents on these residents.
Beautiful. I love it. A man of, a company, a man of a lot of asset classes and know-how with tons of things. I love that. I want to go from mobile You said mobile park, right?
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about that a little bit. Tell us a little bit about that market, about that asset class. I'm not that that much familiar with that. I have a friend who does that, and we've spoken about this several times, but this is a field I would love to hear about. Tell us, how involved are you in it, and why did you get into it? What is exciting about this, and how do you calculate this differently than other type of asset classes?
Yeah, I think the play is really here. It has to come down to understanding affordability, right? I mean, at the end of the day, there's an affordability crisis just in the United States. We understand that for housing. That's pretty well known. Now, when you look at the mobile home space, right, there is a fragmented marketplace. And what I mean by that is that in multifamily, 90% of the owners in multifamily own multiple properties. And so there's been private equity funds, there's been large institutions that have really engaged in the multifamily space. In the mobile home space, 60 to 70% of these parks are still owned by a mom and pop kind of non-institutionalized type of ownership. And so what this provides is opportunities to actually bring systems, processes, and CapEx dollars that they don't necessarily have or want to put into these projects. When you think about it, you know, somebody buys a, you know, what used to be called trailer park, and they sit on it. It's a cash cow if you do it the right way. I mean, you're not really typically owning the actual structures that are on the land. You just own the land and the concrete and then the infrastructure for the park, but you're not necessarily owning all of these actual mobile homes. And so at the end of the day, you have sticky tenants because you know, to move a mobile home park or a mobile home, it really costs, you know, if it's a single wide, around $5,000 to move that from one park to the next. And if it's a double wide, it can be double that price. And so, you know, on average, people typically stay at these mobile home parks for 9 years. So when you think about a multifamily project, you know, leases rolling every 12 months, these folks don't necessarily leave. And at the end of the day, you know, in the Missouri market, at least, you know, rents for just the lot itself can be anywhere between $250 and $500. And then if they own the home themselves outright, then, you know, that's the only expense that they're necessarily have. I got some utilities as well. But it's really been an interesting space to learn about. We have some operating partners that we're partnering with that manage these on a day-to-day basis. We own some multifamily with them. So I've been learning about the industry. I've been learning about the opportunity to put portfolios of these together. So typically these are 50 to 100 lot pad sites that, you know, you don't have a lot of economies of scale. And so the opportunity that I see is entering into a market, purchasing multiple of these, packaging them together, and then selling to a larger REIT, you know, like Sam Zell's REIT. They, you know, he's the largest mobile home or manufactured home community owner in the country. And I think the opportunity there is to grab some decompressing cap rates or compressing cap rates, mind you, with larger scale. And so that's a great opportunity in the space, the fragmented ownership. It actually has value add that you can do in regards to that. And the sticky tenants are just wonderful. So very recession resistant asset class. It's affordable. And, you know, there's a lot less CapEx because you're not really owning any structures. It's really just the park itself, the infrastructure, and the pad sites.
Tell me something. When you come to see your future of your company, do you see yourself more as, I would call, a principal operator, sponsor, finding and dealing and managing those assets, or not even managing, but doing the acquisition, running the whole asset management from above, whether it's multifamily, that obviously you're more involved, or whether it's, you know, the other type of asset classes where maybe you want to be a lot more involved in the future. But when you look at yourself in the future, do you want to be more of a sponsor or more of a private equity LP fund or co-GP, whatever, and to just be the person, be the company, be that entity that is looking for the investors and focus on finding operators, finding those sponsors and finding and actually focus on investors? Where do you want to be in the future?
Well, I think that right now, I mean, being a young company, I think it's really important to understand the business, right? We're not Wall Street guys. We're not just capital allocators. And so I would love at some point to be a capital allocator into real estate because I know how hard it is to own and operate actual real estate projects. Now, before you can do, to, in my opinion, before you can be a capital allocator and be able to vet sponsors and deals and markets and different asset classes, you need to be able to have done that and been there, right? So for us right now, understanding the ins and the outs and actually operating these deals and understanding how to drive value and force appreciation is of the utmost importance. I do believe in the next 5 years or so, we will have partnerships across the United States that will allow us to be able to vet sponsors and markets and deals in a better way because we have gone through it ourselves. But right now, it's really important for us to be owner operators, to get in there, roll our sleeves up, understand what we can do to actually drive value and go through those challenges. So when we face them, or maybe one of our partners faces them in the future, we know how to deal with it. So I don't know exactly, what that time frame looks like. But for us right now, being an operator is where we're going to stay. We're staying close to home in the Midwest, 6.5-7 hours away from Kansas City right now, so we can drive to our assets and get back home and be really, really good operators. So I think that will open up opportunities to do this at scale at a different time. But right now, it's track record, it's operations, it's understanding that and being able to use that knowledge, hopefully in the future, to be a capital allocator to deals across the country.
Logan, tell me about your team a little bit, about the team building, the company that you've built around you. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that culture is extremely important, and so I always say I'm a talent aggregator. I'm always trying to find talent, and we look at it from a couple different perspectives. One, I love prior experience. That's great, but a lot of times in a small business, when you get somebody from a large company that had all of the support and teams and things like that that were necessary, that doesn't necessarily always translate over into a small business. So we look for self-starters. We look for people that are self-motivated, intrinsically motivated. They want to be better and they like the small team aspect, right? So when we first started, it was three guys and our admin, and now it's 22 employees, and we're going to continue to grow that. So it's important to keep that small business feel. And what I mean by the small business feel is if somebody needs something, they can come directly to one of the principals and get an answer. They know where to go and they feel like they have some decision-making abilities. And that's really, really important to try to understand how to grow your team members. We have a lot of young, team members that are new to the business. Well, that's a good thing because we can train them the way that we want them to kind of look at, and they're not maybe bringing in some bad habits or something like that. So for me, it's mostly around delegation and communication. And so for me, I'm always trying to understand how I can be a better communicator, how I can direct, object, or lead people in the right way. And, I think that's really, really important. But it really just comes down to, what's the vision? And are we clear on it? Okay. How are we going to get there? Fantastic. And then communicating across that, horizon as we move forward. So, that's important. We do a lot of culture creators or culture building. So we have, kind of a book club. We have different events that we go to. We like to go to golf tournaments together. We do barbecue tournaments. We do all of that stuff. But at the end of the day, it's in this office every single day, making sure people feel supported and that they have the information and the ability to go be successful in the role that they're at. So that's important. But understanding, too, what people's strengths are and making sure that they're in the right seats is I think, one of the biggest things that a leadership group needs to be focused on, too.
Beautiful. We started talking about this topic before we actually started the show. Where is the market you think is meaning going today? Everybody's talking about it. We're looking at the stock market and some people are talking about a possible, I wouldn't call it Armageddon, but a real correction. Yeah. And many people are talking about the real estate market with the contracting cap rates. And the whole environment is very difficult nowadays and really unknown. A lot of people are really waiting in the sidelines to see where it's going. What is your opinion about where we're going next?
Well, I think it's up to us as the United States to actually be united. And that's one thing that I think is really important. Being productive citizens is extremely important. I think there is no question that we are entering into a period of time that is going to be challenging, in my opinion. So I'm a big reader of Ray Dalio and understanding, his macroeconomic look at things. And he recently wrote a book called The Changing World Order, right? And so, this is where he studied the rise and falls of all the major dynasties and world powers over the last 500 years. And look, he said there's three things going on right now, right? First, the United States is spending a lot more money than it's earning and printing and taxing a lot. Second, we have large wealth, value, and political gaps. And third, potentially being in decline relative to an emerging power, which he says is China. And throw on top of that a war in Ukraine and a global pandemic, right? So I think that you have to be very cautious. I was just meeting with a head of a pretty large bank here in Kansas City for lunch. And I said, hey, man, I'd love some advice. What do you think we should do? He said, look, you need to stay humble. You need to be productive. And you don't want to get yourself in a bad position where you're overextended. And so I think that's really important. In regards to the actual commercial real estate world, I think that people are looking at a lot of correlations between interest rates and cap rates. But at the end of the day, it comes down to how much capital is out there that is chasing yield. And that is what's going to keep cap rates low or not low. And so I think that that's really important. Sure, interest rates rising is going to impact some pricing at the end of the day. But in 2018 and 2019, if I remember right, I was still brokering and buying deals and interest rates were above 5. And that's kind of where we're at now. So if they continue to rise to 7, 8, 9, 10%, then I think we got a little bit of a challenge on our head. But I do not see that happening. I don't know how that can happen. I also do not think that a soft landing from the Federal Reserve is going to be achievable. I just don't know how you print that much money, have the inflation that we do, have the supply chain issues that we do, and somehow get that out of the market. It's just that's something that I think is going to stick around with us for a while. And I think we're seeing as the Fed shrinks its balance sheet, there's a pretty good correlation between that and stock market, and it's starting to contract. And so people are going to be, a little more wary of putting more money into the stock market potentially. And so maybe they're looking for tangible assets, which then could be more capital flowing into real estate and other tangible assets. I don't know necessarily. What I do know is that like you mentioned, people need a place to live. Businesses need a place to operate at. People are still going to shop and they're probably going to go to places. And so investing in that thesis, I think, is good. But you do not want to get into deals that only work with interest only, that have really thin debt service coverage ratios, and that maybe don't cash flow very well or have no plan to cash flow in the near future. I think that fixed rate, long-term debt, cash flow, and DSCR are going to be of utmost importance as we go forward. And so that may mean doing less deals until things happen to turn around, but that's okay. I think that the last thing that anybody wants to do is lose money and put themselves in a bad position.
Beautiful. Before we say our goodbyes, if you could tell us a little bit about your podcasting, your sure. How you put yourself out there. I see that, and hearing you speak is such a pleasure. You have a lot of knowledge. You're 32, am I correct?
Thank you.
32.
That's
young.
Right.
Amazing. And you've gained a lot. You learned a lot. You came from, meaning you're humble. You came, you taught yourself, you built yourself this mini empire, which will hopefully grow and be much, much larger.
Yeah.
And right now you're going forward. Tell us a lot about your educational system to the world.
Sure. Yeah. So, I'm really a big proponent of LinkedIn. I love to post on LinkedIn. I love the collaboration on that platform. So you can find me on LinkedIn. Just search Logan Freeman, Mr. Kansas City. I post on there almost daily. So I love to post things where I'm getting other people's perspectives and then responding in the comments. So please do engage with me there. Our podcast is the Invest for the Win show. My goal is just to bring on really good guests It's really a learning experiment for myself that I can hopefully bring some value to some listeners as well. But trying to ask them questions like you asked me, your questions were very thoughtful today. I really appreciate that. And trying to get other people's perspectives, because you know you can learn through books, you can learn through podcasts and things like that. But what's really important is being able to ask questions to people, have follow-up conversations, and do what we did here today. So that's the Invest for the Win show. Parker, Corey, and myself are on there on a weekly basis interviewing folks that we think will be valuable as well.
Logan, tell everybody where they can find you. You guys obviously can see the links below above, but Logan, please tell us.
And I think LinkedIn would be a great spot for you to follow along and connect with myself, but also ftwinvestmentsllc.com. If you go and put your email address in there, I write a weekly blog that has gotten a lot of attention and people really love. It's kind of a lot of what we talked about here today, you know, topics like when value add is not valuable anymore, or how to rethink your wealth strategy, things like that. I think that those blogs have really been beneficial for folks. And we write those on a weekly basis and have gotten really good feedback. And that's at ftwinvestmentsllc.com.
You guys follow Logan. He has a lot of good stuff.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it, Logan. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. It was my pleasure.
Awesome. And you guys, I'm going to see you in the next show. Hey, guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.